If you're just joining us, this is The 21st Show. I'm Brian Mackey. We're going to shift the focus of our conversation now to harm reduction. What exactly is it? Why does it matter? And what do efforts at harm reduction look like in different parts of the state? Joining me for this conversation was Joe Trotter. He's Harm Reduction Program Coordinator with the Champaign-Urbana Public Health District. And Chris Schaffner, Executive Director of JOLT, a nonprofit organization focused on overdose prevention and harm reduction based in Peoria. Again, we first broadcast this conversation in January. Let's listen to it now. So, Chris, I want to begin with you. There may be people for whom the concept of harm reduction is new. So in a nutshell, what does that mean?
Sure. Harm reduction isn't new. It's not a new concept. Every human on this planet practices some form of harm reduction. If you put sunscreen on when you go out in the sun, you're engaging in harm reduction. If you wear a seatbelt while you're in a car, you're playing harm reduction. This isn't a new idea. It's not novel. It's just we're taking those same principles and applying them to people who are engaged in behaviors that have some potential harm involved and working to help them reduce those harms.
So getting specific about this, this means providing clean needles, Narcan, say more about what it means. Yeah, go ahead.
So I think in our world, when we look at some of the principles that are central to harm reduction, we accept, for better or for worse, that licit and illicit drugs are just a part of our world and that sometimes people choose to use them. They always have, they probably always will. And as a result of that, just because someone does that doesn't mean they don't deserve to experience harms. So we work with them in really pragmatic ways. I like to talk about harm reduction through kind of two lenses. One is harm reduction with a capital H&R, and that looks at things like social injustices and bad drug policy and racial inequity and social determinants that create vulnerabilities from which people develop problematic substance use behaviors. But then also through a very pragmatic lens, and that's where we work on overdose prevention, naloxone distribution, drug checking like fentanyl test strips, FTIR, drug checking machines, syringe access programs. And then for those folks who are interested and ready, linkage to other services. So that might be substance use treatment, might also be housing or employment or mental health support. So it really takes kind of a holistic approach to addressing the individual and their needs. But we also believe that harm reduction should never be coercive. I fundamentally disagree with the idea that we need to start plucking people off the streets and forcing them into treatment settings for a lot of reasons. And that goes contrary to the ideology behind harm reduction is that people have self-determination and agency, and they need to be equipped with tools to empower them to take better care of themselves. And that's what harm reduction really does.
I want to put a pin in that aspect of the conversation and come back to that a little later on. I do want to ask you, though, because you mentioned one of the things you mentioned is test strips for fentanyl. This has gotten a lot of attention in the last few years. But given what we've heard yesterday on the show and even earlier this hour of how prevalent fentanyl is, I wonder, is that even, you know, how important is that still if fentanyl is in almost everything on the street these days?
Well, I think that's a myth. When you look at the drug checking data done by harm reduction programs, not hyperbole from law enforcement drug checking, when you look at harm reduction, fentanyl isn't a great deal of products out there, but it's not in everything. So I think people need to be able to distinguish between a substance that they're consuming that has fentanyl in it and one that doesn't. Because what we find is that when people are empowered with that knowledge and the ability to test, they make safer choices in how they consume, if they even consume at all. But we're always combating misinformation, like fentanyl and cannabis is not a real issue. And there's a lot of scientific reasoning for that. So, you know, we're hard pressed to find heroin on the streets, but most of our meth is not adulterated with fentanyl. We just largely see fentanyl, right? And that's what it is. People need to know. The press pills, yes, they're a thing, but they're not the main thing. So people just need equipped with resources so that will empower them to know what they're doing so they can make informed decisions. And that's what we try to do with our testing.
Joe Trotter, I want to bring you into the conversation now with the Champaign-Urbana Public Health District. Champaign County has been ahead of the curve, I think, in offering needle exchange services for many years now. That is specifically aimed at reducing the transmission of viruses like hepatitis C, for example, among people who use intravenous drugs. I wonder how people react when they find out that, you know, you, a government employee, a health department guy, wants to give them supplies like needles and fentanyl test strips.
Sure. Yeah, it's often a surprise. I have a lot of clients that say, like, I've never had a conversation like this before, you know, when I'm giving them the supplies that they need and talking to them about, you know, their drug use and going into specifics of their drug use of, like, what type of tourniquet do you use? How do you clean your arm beforehand? You know, where in your room are you set up? Like, we go through those real kind of nitty-gritty specifics with people sometimes because, you know, not only is there a viral transmission risk with HIV or hepatitis C, but there's also a bacteria risk where someone can get bacteria in their veins and have really bad wounds. So we do a lot of kind of wound care, wound prevention work at the same time. That also is going to reduce stigma because, you know, when people have wounds at their arms, people treat them differently, unfortunately. So it's a very odd conversation. It's a very real conversation. It's usually very short also. You know, we have just a few minutes to kind of talk to them and, you know, explain and answer any questions they have and kind of get an understanding of where they're at. So, it's a very odd interaction.
Chris, you heard Joe there saying that people are surprised about to have that sort of conversation. More generally, in the healthcare setting, Chris, what do you hear from people about the way they're treated by healthcare providers?
Our people largely avoid healthcare settings whenever they need to, because of the fear of stigma, whether it's real or perceived. There's stigma. I worked in healthcare for years as a paramedic. I worked in emergency rooms here locally. I ashamedly participated in that type of cultural dialogue when I worked there in the 90s and learned better. And once you learn better, you must do better. But our folks largely avoid healthcare settings altogether for that same reason. To go in and to show your arms that are torn up or you have wounds from xylazine or abscesses or just injection marks, there's a palpable change in someone's attitude when they realize that you're a drug user. They just assume that you're here for nefarious reasons or that you're drug seeking or you're somehow the only person responsible for the horrible mess you've made of your life. And therefore, you should be shamed and coerced and threatened and feared into making changes. And so they avoid it altogether. When they engage programs like Joe's and ours, and they realize that we have normalized conversations where we normalize this behavior in a sense that it removes stigma, that they begin to trust us and open up more and more and more. And the more open and honest someone is, the more we can help them explore different ways of navigating the life that they have. And what's really ironic and not intentional, but the outcomes are almost always better. People who engage in harm reduction services that are non-coercive and non-judgmental actually are 5 to 8 times more likely to seek out some type of recovery on their own.
All right, we're gonna have to pause the conversation there, and we will continue this after a short break. This is the 21st Show. If you're just joining us, this is the 21st Show. I'm Brian Mackey. All this week, we're focusing on fentanyl. Today, we've heard about addiction, recovery, and treatment. That's how we started our program. Now we are talking about harm reduction with Joe Trotter from the Champaign-Urbana Public Health District and Chris Schaffner with the nonprofit organization JOLT, based in Peoria. We originally broadcast this series of conversations in January, so obviously our show is on tape today, but let us know what you think anytime by emailing talk@21stshow.org. I want to talk about Joe, let me ask you about this, because I've read where people can be really conflicted about harm reduction, right? I think it was NPR had a story about a mother who had lost her daughter to substance use and went into this work of harm reduction and then had grieving family members confront her mm-hmm. about enabling their kids' overdose, for example. Yeah. How do you respond to that?
Yeah, it's a very common misconception that people think that harm reduction programs enable drug use. Drug use is going to happen whether a harm reduction practice is there or not. A harm reduction practice goal is to make sure that people can stay safe while they're using the drug. When harm reduction practices are not there, then we see increases in viral transmission of HIV and hepatitis C. We see increases in overdoses. Particularly overdose deaths. We see increased ER visits with abscesses and wounds. So it's a very common misconception that people think that you're enabling someone to use drugs or abdicating on their behalf to use drugs, that's not our intention. Our intention is to try and help someone stay safe today, tomorrow, maybe the next few days. We don't have this like enormous lifetime goal of, this long-term lofty goal of trying to dramatically improve someone's life. That's not the goal of harm reduction. Harm reduction is not harm removal. You know, we're not trying to stop someone from harming them. We are trying to help them make an informed choice about their drug use. And so sometimes it's very, very little small things that people need. You know, I get these really bad wounds on my arm. How do I prevent those? Well, let's make sure you have an alcohol pad to clean your arm before you use a drug. Very, very simple, a very easy technique, but dramatically improves that person's livelihood, which is really the goal of harm reduction is, very simple.
Joe, I also want to ask you about this idea, anyone in Illinois could set up a needle exchange, right? And receive, you get legal protections for carrying large quantities of drug paraphernalia, which might be a problem with law enforcement otherwise, sure. But yet these don't exist everywhere. Why not?
It's hard to fund them. They do take a lot of money to stay active, it's talking about supplies. There's a lot of supplies, a lot of tangible things that you have to purchase to give to people that they need it. So the syringes cost money, the alcohol pads cost money, all the little quote unquote paraphernalia that people get, all of those cost money. So that's not cheap. And so it is very hard to find a reliable funding source for harm reduction programs in the state. It's gotten a lot better. Even in the past 5 years, it's gotten a lot better for programs like ours to exist. I'm not saying it's easy, and Chris, I'm sure can talk about that too. We could probably have a whole other show dedicated to how hard it is to keep the lights on and keep the bills paid for programs like ours. Anyone can do it. You don't need anyone's permission to do it, but it doesn't mean that the work's not easy and that it doesn't mean that there's always going to be money available to, to keep the work active.
Well, let's get into that then. It's a good segue because Chris, there is a lot of new money flowing to state and local governments to help with the opioid crisis. Billions of dollars from these legal settlements with the Sacklers and their Purdue Pharma pharmaceutical companies that perpetuated this crisis. We're going to talk more about that specifically on Thursday's show this week. But are you helpful about this influx of cash?
I'm cautiously hopeful. We're already seeing evidence that this money is being co-opted by large healthcare systems, and that most harm reduction programs are not embedded in health departments. They're small, standalone CBO nonprofits like mine. And so often we don't have the grant writing capacity, we don't have the staffing, we lack funding. And so being able to access that money is a challenge. So I'm cautiously hopeful, but what we are finding is that whenever there's large sums of money, there's always somebody there that's trying to get their hands in that pot too, that doesn't necessarily have the same agenda that we do. And given that harm reduction's on the front line, we're the ones that are distributing naloxone, are the ones working with people who are at highest risk. I think we need the lion's share of that funding so that we can build out a more harm reduction, a robust harm reduction statewide network where we can engage people who use drugs and services.
I want to get into something we sort of hinted at earlier, and this relates back to something we talked about yesterday on the show. Chris, you've talked about harm reduction being a way to build power, collective power, with people who are marginalized, to empower them. Yesterday on our program, though, the journalist Sam Quiñones, who spent 15 years covering the opioid epidemic across two books, he argued that the fentanyl and meth that dominate today's drug use, it really robs people of the agency they need to opt in to recovery.
This is a compassionate response, leaving people on the street to say, well, whenever you're ready, just let us know, or we're going to come by endlessly and ask you, and you can keep on saying no, and eventually we hope you'll say yes one day. Those people will die. You do not have the time to develop the readiness before meth drives you mad, basically crazy, and fentanyl kills you. And that's why I think ideas that made sense in another era are now not making sense when the drugs on the street are fentanyl or meth in these profound potencies and enormous quantities that we're seeing.
So his argument is nuanced. There's a piece in the Atlantic magazine. We link to it on our website. You can read that, if people can read that if they want. But he basically thinks it's more compassionate to use the power of the law to compel people into detox, because these chemicals in particular won't let them do it on their own. Chris, what do you think of that?
I think that's fundamentally flawed and dangerous ideology. I think Sam is problematic and contributes to the growing overdose epidemic that we have, and he should be held liable for it. All he's calling for is more of the same of what we've always done with the war on drugs, which is just fear-mongering and criminalizing people who use drugs and forcing them to do things against their will. I don't see that here on the streets. Working with people who are at highest risk, I don't see that. What I see is when people are empowered with education and resources and a compassionate, non-judgmental approach, they begin to make incremental changes. The problem isn't the drugs. The problem are the drug policies that create the risk. Fentanyl is used every single day in clinical settings, and there are controls in those settings that make it safe to do so. But those controls don't exist outside of a clinical setting, and that's where the harm is. The drugs are dangerous on the street because it's unregulated. The controls of safety and delivery are non-existent because of the laws, and the stigma still exists, and that drives people further underground. I mean, there's studies now that show whenever there's a large drug bust by law enforcement where they remove a known supply from a community, that overdose fatalities increase significantly in the next 2 weeks following that drug bust. We can no longer rely on law enforcement and the criminal justice field to address this public health crisis. We need to extricate law enforcement and the criminal justice system from this altogether, because they are the ones that are driving the overdose crisis to begin with.
And just to be fair to Sam, I think his argument would say that, no, you can't just go back to the 80s and the war on drugs. You really need to bring a much more compassionate form of treatment into this as well. But Joe, what is your perspective on this?
Well, I think it does start with compassion. I didn't hear a lot of compassion in Sam's quote, and I know it's only a snippet there, but it really does start with we need to realize that people should have the freedom to do whatever they want to do, which means they should have a freedom to use something that can hurt them. We had an era called Prohibition where we said, alcohol is illegal and you can't drink it anymore. And what did people do? They kept drinking it. They found a way to use it. People are going to continue to use drugs. We can't stop that from happening. We don't need to stop that from happening. What we need is to show compassion for the people while they are still using those drugs. And the healthcare system, the justice system, the law enforcement system, they have not done a good job of that. You know, they penalize people for using drugs rather than showing them compassion. And compassion is like, hey, how are you today? What do you need today? What can we do to help keep you safe? Those are the messages that they're getting in harm reduction efforts that they're just not getting anywhere else. So it really does start with really going up against the systems that are in place that continue to stigmatize people that use drugs. And the systems are only ready to accept them when they say they want to stop using. And that's failure in my mind. You need to be able to say, like, you can continue to use your drug and still come to the ER and get the best form of healthcare possible to you. Everybody deserves that, regardless of their drug use or not drug use.
This is probably going to be the last exchange we'll have time for, but I do want to talk about the next frontier of harm reduction. And Chris, going beyond, you know, needle exchange, there are places trying what are called supervised injection sites. That is a bridge too far for some. In fact, they're illegal in Illinois. Make the case for them.
Yeah, when we criminalize drug use, people use in isolation. It doesn't stop drug use. So that just people use in isolation. And when people use in isolation, they die, because there's no one there to address any adverse events that occur while they're using. So again, just like I said about hospital settings, when people are given fentanyl in that setting, we control the dose, we know the purity of the medication, it's medical grade, it's delivered in a sterile and safe way, and there are people who are trained to monitor for adverse reactions and they can respond immediately. And because of that, we don't have an overdose crisis in healthcare settings. We do on the streets. So an overdose prevention site or a safe consumption site is literally just, we have trained staff who can respond to an overdose while somebody is using under a watchful eye, because that's the humane thing to do. Mm-hmm. Because what I do agree with Sam is people are dying out there on the streets, but they're dying because of bad drug policy and because of shame and fear of stigma. And if we can remove that and watch them and provide them medical care that they need, we will not only save lives, we're going to be more likely to engage people in more holistic services that can help them and benefit them and benefit our community as a whole.
Chris Schaffner is executive director of JOLT, which is a nonprofit organization based in Peoria. Joe Trotter is harm reduction program coordinator with the Champaign-Urbana Public Health District. Chris and Joe, really interesting conversation. Thank you for being with us today on the 21st Show.
Thanks for having us.
Thank you.
And that is all the time we have for today. We're going to continue listening back to this series of fentanyl-related conversations all week. If you have a perspective you'd like to share or something you think we should be talking about in the future, you can find all the ways to contact us through our website, 21stshow.org. While you're there, you can also listen to our conversation yesterday with Sam Quinones and decide for yourself about what he argues needs to change in the way we handle treatment. You can also hear our earlier conversation today or share it with someone you think might want to hear it. And if you join us on the program tomorrow, you'll hear a conversation about the politics of fentanyl. We'll hear about some of the competing views on how best to prevent this death that is happening out there in our communities. Thursday, we'll focus on different solutions people are trying, from what governments are doing with billions of dollars in opioid settlement money to attempts to reach people one by one in hospital emergency rooms. We'll hear from somebody doing just that work in Illinois. And Friday, we'll probe how best to talk to our young people about drugs, moving beyond the Just Say No campaigns many of us grew up with. You can find all those conversations at our website, 21stshow.org. The 21st Show is produced by Christine Hatfield and Jose Zepeda. Today's show was produced in part by Kennedy Vincent, and special help for this week's programs came from Christine Herman. Our digital producer is Stephanie Mosqueda. Technical direction and engineering comes from Jason Croft and Steve Mork. Reginald Hardwick is our news director. Thanks to the band Public Access for our theme music. The 21st Show is a production of Illinois Public Media. I'm Brian Mackey. Thanks for listening. We'll talk with you again tomorrow.